Sociologist Voy was staring at the bluish scene in the 2481st, where earlier there had been all the activity of a busy spaceport. He barely looked up when Harlan entered. He barely mumbled something that might have been a greeting. A change had indeed blasted the spaceport. Its shininess was gone. What buildings there stood were not the grand creations they had been. A spaceship rusted. There were no people. There was no motion. Harlan allowed himself a small smile that flickered for a moment, then vanished. It was MDR, all right. Maximum desired response. And it had happened at once. The change did not necessarily take place at the precise moment of the technician's touch. If the calculations that went into the touch were sloppy, hours or days might elapse before the change actually took place, counting, of course, by physio time. It was only when all degrees of freedom vanished that the change took place. While there was even a mathematical chance for alternate actions, the change did not take place. It was Harlan's pride that when he calculated an MNC, when it was his hand that contrived the touch, the degrees of freedom vanished at once, and the change took place instantly. Voy said softly, "It had been very beautiful." The phrase grated Harlan's ears, seeming to detract from the beauty of his own performance. "I wouldn't regret," he said, "having space travel bred out of reality altogether."
"No?"
said Voy. "What good is it? It never lasts more than a millennium or two. People get tired. They come back home and the colonies die out. Then after another 4 or 5 millennia, or 40 or 50, they try again and it fails again. It is a waste of human ingenuity and effort." Voy said dryly, "You're quite a philosopher." Harlan flushed. He thought, "What's the use in talking to any of them?" He said angrily, with a sharp change of subject, "What about the life plotter?"
"What about him?"
"Would you check with the man? He ought to have made some progress by now." The sociologist let a look of disapproval drift across his face, as though to say, "You're the impatient one, aren't you?" Aloud he said, "Come with me, and let's see." The nameplate on the office door said Niran Farouk, which struck Harlan's eye and mind because of its faint similarity to a pair of rulers in the Mediterranean era during primitive times. His weekly discourses with Cooper had sharpened his own preoccupation with the primitive almost feverishly. The man, however, resembled neither ruler, as Harlan recalled it. He was almost cadaverously lean, with skin stretched tightly over a high-bridged nose. His fingers were long, and his wrists knobby. As he caressed his small summiter, he looked like death, weighing a soul in the balance. Harlan found himself staring at the summiter hungrily. It was the heart and blood of life-plotting, the skin and bones, sinew, muscle, and all else. Feed into it the required data of a personal history and the equations of the reality change. Do that, and it would chuckle away in obscene merriment for any length of time, from a minute to a day, and then spit out the possible companion lives for the person involved, under the new reality, each neatly ticketed with a probability value. Sociologist Voy introduced Harlan. Farouk, having stared in open annoyance at the technician's insignia, nodded his head and let the matter go. Harlan said, "Is the young lady's life plot complete yet?"
"It is not. I'll let you know when it is."
He was one of those who carried contempt for the technician to the point of open rudeness. Voy said,
"Take it easy, life plotter."
Farouk had eyebrows which were light almost to invisibility. It heightened the resemblance of his face to a skull. His eyes rolled in what should have been empty sockets as he said,
"Killed the spaceships?"
Voy nodded.
"Cut it down a century."
Farouk's lips twisted softly and formed a word. Harlan folded his arms and stared at the life plotter, who looked away in eventual discomfiture. Harlan thought, He knows it's his guilt, too. Farouk said to Voy,
Listen, as long as you're here, what in time am I going to do about the anti-cancer serum requests? We're not the only century with anti-cancer. Why do we get all the applications? All the other centuries are just as crowded, you know that. Then they've got to stop sending in applications altogether.
How do we go about making them?
Easy. Let the Alwyn Council stop receiving them.
I have no pull with the Alwyn Council.
You have pull with the old man.
Harlan listened to the conversation dully, without real interest. At least it served to keep his mind on inconsequentials and away from the chuckling summiter. The old man, he knew, would be the computer in charge of the section.
I've talked to the old man, said the sociologist, and he's talked to the council. Nuts. He's just sent through a routine tape strip. He has to fight for this. It's a matter of basic policy.
The Alwyn Council isn't in the mood these days to consider changes in basic policy. You know the rumors going round?
Oh, sure. They're busy on a big deal. Whenever there's dodging to do, the word gets round that the council's busy on some big deal.
If Harlan could have found the heart for it, he would have smiled at that point. Farouk brooded a few moments, and then burst out.
What most people don't understand is that anti-cancer serum isn't a matter of tree seedlings or field motors. I know that every sprig of spruce has to be watched for adverse effects on reality, but anti-cancer always involves a human life, and that's 100 times as complicated. Consider. Think how many people a year die of cancer in each century that doesn't have anti-cancer serums of one sort or another. You can imagine how many of the patients want to die. So the timer governments in every century are forever forwarding applications to eternity to please, pretty please, ship them 75,000 ampules of serum on behalf of the men critically stricken who are absolutely vital to the cultures, enclosed see biographical data.
Voy nodded rapidly.
I know, I know.
But Farouk was not to be denied his bitterness.
So you read the biographical data, and it's every man a hero. Every man an insupportable loss to his world. So you work it through. You see what would happen to reality if each man lived, and for time's sake, if different combinations of men lived. In the last month, I've done 572 cancer requests. 17, count them, 17 life plots came out to involve no undesirable reality changes. Mind you, there wasn't one case of a possible desirable reality change, but the council says neutral cases get the serum. Humanity, you know. So exactly 17 people in assorted centuries get cured this month. And what happens? Are the centuries happy? Not on your life. One man gets cured and a dozen, same country, same time, don't. Everyone says, why that one? Maybe the guys we didn't treat are better characters. Maybe they're rosy-cheeked philanthropists, beloved by all, while the one man we cure kicks his aged mother all around the block whenever he can spare the time from beating his kids. They don't know about reality changes, and we can't tell them. We're just making trouble for ourselves, Voy, unless the All-Wen Council decides to screen all applications and approve only those which result in a desirable reality change, that's all. Either curing them does some good for humanity, or else it's out. Never mind this business of saying, well, it does no harm.
The sociologist had been listening with a look of mild pain on his face, and now he said, if it were you with cancer.
That's a stupid remark, Voy. Is that what we base decisions on? In that case, there'd never be a reality change. Some poor sucker always gets it in the neck, doesn't he? Suppose you were that sucker, hey? And another thing. Just remember that every time we make a reality change, it's harder to find a good next one. Every physio year, the chance that a random change is likely to be for the worse increases. That means the proportion of guys we can cure gets smaller anyway. It's always going to get smaller. Someday we'll be able to cure only one guy a physio year, even counting the neutral cases. Remember that.
Harlan lost even the faintest interest. This was the type of griping that went with the business. The psychologists and sociologists, in their rare introvertive studies of eternity, called it identification. Men identified themselves with the century with which they were associated professionally. Its battles, all too often, became their own battles. Eternity fought the devil of identification as best it could. No man could be assigned to any section within two centuries of his home when, to make identification harder. Preference was given to centuries with cultures markedly different from that of their home when. Harlan thought of Finge and the 482nd. What was more, their assignments were shifted as often as their reactions grew suspect. Harlan wouldn't give a 50th century Groffin piece for Farouk's chances of retaining this assignment longer than another physio year at the outside. And still, men identified out of a silly yearning for a home in time. The time wish. Everyone knew about it. For some reason, this was particularly true in centuries with space travel. It was something that should be investigated, and would be, but for eternity's chronic reluctance to turn its eyes inward. A month earlier, Harlan might have despised Farouk as a blustering sentimentalist, a petulant oaf who eased the pain of watching the electrogravitics lose intensity in a new reality by railing against those of other centuries who wanted anti-cancer serum. He might have reported him. It would have been his duty to do so. The man's reactions obviously could no longer be trusted. He could not do so now. He even found sympathy for the man. His own crime was so much greater. How easy it was to slip back to thoughts of Noyes. Eventually, he had fallen asleep that night, and he awoke in daylight, with brightness shining through translucent walls all about, until it was as though he had awakened on a cloud in a misty morning sky. Noyes was laughing down at him.
Goodness, it was hard to wake you.
Harlan's first reflexive action was a scrabble for bedclothes that weren't there. Then memory arrived, and he stared at her hollowly, his face burning red. How should he feel about this? But then something else occurred to him, and he shot to a sitting position. It isn't past one, is it?
Father, time!
It's only 11. You've got breakfast waiting and lots of time.
Thanks, he mumbled.
The shower controls are all set, and your clothes are all ready.
What could he say? Thanks, he mumbled. He avoided her eyes during the meal. She sat opposite him, not eating, her chin buried in the palm of one hand, her dark hair combed thickly to one side, and her eyelashes preternaturally long. She followed every gesture he made while he kept his eyes lowered and searched for the bitter shame he knew he ought to feel. She said,
"Where will you be going at 1?
"Aero ball game," he muttered. "I have the ticket."
"That's the rubber game. And I missed the whole season because of just skipping the time, you know. Who'll win the game, Andrew?"
He felt oddly weak at the sound of his first name. He shook his head curtly and tried to look austere.
It used to have been so easy. "But surely you know. You've inspected this whole period, haven't you?"
Properly speaking, he ought to maintain a flat and cold negative, but weakly, he explained. There was a lot of space and time to cover. I wouldn't know little precise things like game scores.
"Oh, you just don't want to tell me."
Harlan said nothing to that. He inserted the penne prong into the small, juicy fruit and lifted it, whole, to his lips. After a moment, Noyes said,
"Did you see what happened in this neighborhood before you came?"
"No details, Noyes." He forced her name past his lips. The girl said softly,
"Didn't you see us? Didn't you know all along that—"
Harlan stammered. No, I couldn't see myself. I'm not here till I come. I can't explain." He was doubly flustered. First, that she should speak of it. Second, that he had almost been trapped into saying reality of all the words, the most forbidden in conversations with timers. She lifted her eyebrows and her eyes grew round and a little amazed.
Are you ashamed?
What we did was not proper.
Why not?
And in the 482nd, her question was perfectly innocent.
Aren't Eternals allowed to?
There was almost a joking cast to that question, as though she were asking if Eternals weren't allowed to eat.
Don't use the word,
said Harlan. As a matter of fact, we're not, in a way.
Well then, don't tell them. I won't.
And she walked about the table and sat down on his lap, pushing the small table out of the way with a smooth and flowing motion of her hip. Momentarily, he stiffened, lifted his hand in a gesture that might have been intended to hold her off. It didn't succeed. She bent and kissed him on his lips, and nothing seemed shameful anymore. Nothing that involved Noyes and himself. He wasn't sure when first he began to do something that an observer ethically had no right to do. That is, he began to speculate on the nature of the problem involving the current reality and of the reality change that would be planned. It was not the loose morals of the century, not ectogenesis, not matriarchy that disturbed eternity. All of that was as it was in the previous reality, and the All-Wen Council had viewed it with equanimity then. Finge had said it was something very subtle. The change, then, would have to be very subtle, and it would have to involve the group he was observing. So much seemed obvious. It would involve the aristocracy, the well-to-do, the upper classes, the beneficiaries of the system. What bothered him was that it would most certainly involve Noyes. He got through the remaining 3 days called for in his chart in a gathering cloud that dampened even his joy of Noyes's company. She said to him,
"What happened? For a while you seemed all different from the way you were in in that place. You weren't stiff at all. Now you seem concerned. Is it because you have to go back?"
Harlan said, partly.
"Do you have to?"
"I have to."
"Well, who would care if you were late?"
Harlan almost smiled at that. "They wouldn't like me to be late," he said, yet thought longingly just the same of the 2-day margin allowed for in his chart. She adjusted the controls of a musical instrument that played soft and complicated strains out of its own creative bowels by striking notes and chords in a random manner. The randomness weighted in favor of pleasant combinations by intricate mathematical formulae. The music could no more repeat itself than could snowflakes, and could no more fail of beauty. Through the hypnosis of sound, Harlan gazed at Noyes, and his thoughts wound tightly about her. What would she be in the new dispensation? A fishwife? A factory girl? The mother of six? Fat, ugly, diseased? Whatever she was, she would not remember Harlan. He would have been no part of her life in a new reality. And whatever she would be then, she would not be Noyes. He did not simply love a girl. Strangely, he used the word love in his own thoughts for the first time and did not even pause long enough to stare at the strange thing and wonder at it. He loved a complex of factors, her choice of clothes, her walk, her manner of speech, her tricks of expression. A quarter century of life and experience in a given reality had gone into the manufacture of all that. She had not been his Noyes in the previous reality of a physio year earlier. She would not be his Noyes in the next reality. The new Noyes might conceivably be better in some ways, but he knew one thing very definitely. He wanted this Noyes here, the one he saw at this moment, the one of this reality. If she had faults, he wanted those faults too.
What could he do?
Several things occurred to him, all illegal. One of them was to learn the nature of the change and find out definitely how it would affect Noyes. One could not, after all, be certain that A dead silence wrenched Harlan out of his reverie. He was in the life plotter's office once more. Sociologist Voy was watching him out of the corner of his eye. Farouk's death's head was lowering at him. And the silence was piercing. It took a moment for the significance to penetrate. Just a moment. The summiter had ceased its inner clucking. Harlan jumped up. You have the answer, life plotter. Farouk looked down at the flimsies in his hand.
Yeah, sure. Sort of funny.
May I have it? Harlan held out his hand. It was trembling visibly.
There's nothing to see. That's what's funny.
What do you mean, nothing? Harlan stared at Farouk with eyes that suddenly smarted till there was only a tall, thin blur where Farouk stood. The life plotter's matter-of-fact voice sounded thin.
The dame doesn't exist in the new reality. No personality shift, she's just out, that's all, gone. I ran the alternatives down to probability 0.0001. She doesn't make it anywhere, in fact.
And he reached up to rub his cheek with long, spare fingers.
With the combination of factors you handed me, I don't quite see how she fit in the old reality.
Harlan hardly heard. But the change was such a small one.
I know. A funny combination of factors. Here, you want the flimsies?
Harlan's hand closed over them, unfeeling. Noyes gone? Noyes non-existent? How could that be? He felt a hand on his shoulder, and Voy's voice clashed on his ear.
Are you ill, technician?
The hand drew away as though it already regretted its careless contact with a technician's body. Harlan swallowed, and with an effort composed his features.
I'm quite well. Would you take me to the kettle?
He must not show his feelings. He must act as though this were what he represented it to be, a mere academic investigation. He must disguise the fact that with Noyes's non-existence in the new reality, he was almost physically overwhelmed by a flood of pure elation, unbearable joy. Chapter 7. Prelude to Crime. Harlan stepped into the kettle at the 2456th and looked backward to make certain that the barrier that separated the shaft from eternity was truly flawless, that sociologist Voy was not watching. In these last weeks, it had grown to be a habit with him, an automatic twitch. There was always the quick backward glance across the shoulder to make sure no one was behind him in the kettle shafts. And then, though already in the 2456th, it was for up when that Harlan set the kettle controls. He watched the numbers on the temperometer rise. Though they moved with blurry quickness, there would be considerable time for thought. How the life plotter's finding changed matters. How the very nature of his crime had changed. And it had all hinged on Finge. The phrase caught at him with its ridiculous rhyme, and its heavy beat circled dizzyingly inside his skull. It hinged on Finge. It hinged on Finge. Harlan had avoided any personal contact with Finge on his return to eternity after those days with Noyes in the 482nd. As eternity closed in about him, so did guilt. A broken oath of office, which seemed nothing in the 482nd, was enormous in eternity. He had sent in his report by impersonal airshoot and took himself off to personal quarters. He needed to think this out, gain time to consider, and grow accustomed to the new orientation within himself. Finge did not permit it. He was in communication with Harlan less than an hour after the report had been coded for proper direction and inserted into the chute. The computer's image stared out of the vision plate. His voice said,
I expected you to be in your office.
Harlan said, I delivered the report, sir. It doesn't matter where I wait for a new assignment.
Yes?
Finge scanned the roll of foil he held in his hands, holding it up, squint-eyed, and peering at its perforation pattern.
It is scarcely complete, he went on. May I visit your rooms?
Harlan hesitated a moment. The man was his superior, and to refuse the self-invitation at this moment would have a flavor of insubordination. It would advertise his guilt, it seemed, and his raw, painful conscience dared not permit that. "You will be welcome, computer," he said stiffly. Finge's sleek softness introduced a jarring element of Epicureanism into Harlan's angular quarters. The 95th, Harlan's home when, tended toward the Spartan in house furnishings, and Harlan had never completely lost his taste for the style. The tubular metal chairs had been surfaced with a dull veneer that had been artificially grained into the appearance of wood, though not very successfully. In one corner of the room was a small piece of furniture that represented an even wider departure from the customs of the times. It caught Finge's eye almost at once. The computer put a pudgy finger on it, as though to test its texture.
"What is this material?"
"Wood, sir," said Harlan.
"The real thing? Actual wood? Amazing. You use wood in your home when, I believe?"
"We do."
"I see. There's nothing in the rules against this, technician."
He dusted the finger with which he had touched the object against the side seam of his trouser leg.
"But I don't know that it's advisable to allow the culture of the home when to affect one. The true eternal adopts whatever culture he is surrounded by. I doubt, for instance, if I have eaten out of an energic utensil more than twice in 5 years."
He sighed.
"And yet to allow food to touch matter has always seemed unclean. But I don't give in. I don't give in."
His eyes returned to the wooden object, but now he held both hands behind his back and said,
"What is it? What is its purpose?"
"It's a bookcase," said Harlan. He had the impulse to ask Finge how he felt now that his hands rested firmly upon the small of his back. Would he not consider it cleaner to have his clothes and his own body constructed of pure and undefiled energy fields? Finge's eyebrows lifted.
"A bookcase. Then those objects resting upon the shelves are books, is that right?"
"Yes, sir."
"Authentic specimens?"
"Entirely, computer. I picked them up in the 24th. The few I have here date from the 20th. If you intend to look at them, I wish you'd be careful. The pages have been restored and impregnated, but they're not foil. They take careful handling."
"I won't touch them. I have no intention of touching them. Original 20th century dust is on them, I imagine. Actual books."
He laughed. "Pages of cellulose, too? You implied that." Harlan nodded. "Cellulose modified by the impregnation treatment for longer life, yes." He opened his mouth for a deep breath, forcing himself to remain calm. It was ridiculous to identify himself with these books, to feel a slur upon them, to be a slur upon himself.
"I dare say," said Finge, still on the subject, "that the whole content of those books could be placed on 2 meters of film and stored in a finger's end. What do the books contain?"
Harlan said, "They are bound volumes of a news magazine of the 20th.
"You read that?"
Harlan said proudly, "These are a few volumes of the complete collection I have. No library in eternity can duplicate it."
"Yes, your hobby. I remember now you once told me about your interest in the primitive. I'm amazed your educator ever allowed you to grow interested in such a thing, a complete waste of energy."
Harlan's lips thinned. The man, he decided, was deliberately trying to irritate him out of possession of calm reasoning faculties. If so, he must not be allowed to succeed. Harlan said flatly, "I think you've come to see me about my report."
"Yes, I have."
The computer looked about, selected a chair, and sat down gingerly.
"It is not complete, as I said over the communicator."
"In what way, sir?"
"Calm, calm."
Finge broke into a nervous twitch of a smile.
"What happened that you didn't mention, Harlan?"
"Nothing, sir." And though he said it firmly, he stood there, hangdog.
"Come, technician. You spent several periods of time in the society of the young lady. Or you did if you followed the spatio-temporal chart. You did follow it, I suppose."
Harlan's guilt riddled him to the point where he could not even rise to the bait of this open assault upon his professional competence. He could only say, "I followed it."
"And what happened? You include nothing of the private interludes with the woman?"
"Nothing of importance happened," said Harlan, dry-lipped.
"That is ridiculous. At your time of life and with your experience, I don't have to tell you that it is not for an observer to judge what is important and what is not."
Finch's eyes were keenly upon Harlan. They were harder and more eager than quite befitted his soft line of questioning. Harlan noted that well, and was not fooled by Finch's gentle voice, yet the habit of duty tugged at him. An observer must report everything. An observer was merely a sense-perceptive pseudopod, thrust out by eternity into time. It tested its surroundings and was drawn back. In the fulfillment of his function, an observer had no individuality of his own. He was not really a man. Almost automatically, Harlan began his narration of the events he had left out of his report. He did it with the trained memory of the observer, reciting the conversations with word-for-word accuracy, reconstructing the tone of voice and cast of countenance. He did it lovingly, for in the telling he lived it again, and almost forgot, in the process, that a combination of Finch's probing and his own healing sense of duty was driving him into an admission of guilt. It was only as he approached the end result of that first long conversation that he faltered and the shell of his observer's objectivity showed cracks. He was saved from further details by the hand that Finch suddenly raised and by the computer's sharp, edgy voice.
"Thank you, it is enough. You were about to say that you made love to the woman."
Harlan grew angry. What Finch said was the literal truth, but Finch's tone of voice made it sound lewd, coarse, and worse than that, commonplace. Whatever else it was, or might be, it was not commonplace. Harlan had an explanation for Finch's attitude, for his anxious cross-examination, for his breaking off the verbal report at the moment he did. Finch was jealous. That much Harlan would have sworn was obvious. Harlan had succeeded in taking away a girl that Finch had meant to have. Harlan felt the triumph in that and found it sweet. For the first time in his life he knew an aim that meant more to him than the frigid fulfillment of eternity. He was going to keep Finch jealous because Noyes Lambent was to be permanently his. In this mood of sudden exaltation, he plunged into the request that originally he had planned to present only after a wait of a discreet 4 or 5 days. He said, "It is my intention to apply for permission to form a liaison with a timed individual." Finch seemed to snap out of a reverie.
"With Noyes Lambent, I presume?"
"Yes, sir. As computer in charge of the section, it will have to go through you." Harlan wanted it to go through Finch. Make him suffer. If he wanted the girl himself, let him say so, and Harlan could insist on allowing Noyes to make her choice. He almost smiled at that. He hoped it would come to that. It would be the final triumph. Ordinarily, of course, a technician could not hope to push through such a matter in the face of a computer's desires, but Harlan was sure he could count on Twistle's backing, and Finch had a long way to go before he could buck Twistle. Finch, however, seemed tranquil.
"It would seem," he said, "that you have already taken illegal possession of the girl."
Harlan flushed and was moved to a feeble defense. "The spatiotemporal chart insisted on our remaining alone together. Since nothing of what happened was specifically forbidden, I feel no guilt." Which was a lie, and from Finch's half-amused expression, one could feel that he knew it to be a lie. He said,
"There will be a reality change."
Harlan said, "If so, I will amend my application to request liaison with Miss Lambent in the new reality."
"I don't think that would be wise. How can you be sure in advance? In the new reality, she may be married. She may be deformed. In fact, I can tell you this. In the new reality, She will not want you. She will not want you.
Harlan quivered. You know nothing about it.
Oh?
You think this great love of yours is a matter of soul-to-soul contact? That it will survive all external changes? Have you been reading novels out of time?
Harlan was goaded into indiscretion. For one thing, I don't believe you.
Finch said coldly,
I beg pardon.
You're lying. Harlan didn't care what he said now. You're jealous. It's all it amounts to, you're jealous. You had your own plans for Noyes, but she chose me.
Finch said, Do you realize?
I realize a great deal. I'm no fool. I may not be a computer, but neither am I an ignoramus. You say she won't want me in the new reality. How do you know? You don't even know yet what the new reality will be. You don't know if there must be a new reality at all. You just received my report. It must be analyzed before a reality change can be computed, let alone submitted for approval. So when you affect to know the nature of the change, you are lying.
There were a number of ways in which Finch might have made response. Harlan's heated mind was aware of many. He did not try to choose among them.
Finch might stalk out in affected dudgeon. He might call in a member of security and have Harlan taken into custody for insubordination. He might shout back, yelling as angrily as Harlan. He might put in an immediate call to Twistle, lodging a formal complaint. He might.
Finch did none of this. He said gently,
Sit down, Harlan. Let's talk about this.
And because that response was completely unexpected, Harlan's jaw sagged, and he sat down in confusion. His resolution faltered. What was this?
You remember, of course, said Finch, that I told you that our problem with the 482nd involved an undesirable attitude on the part of the timers of the current reality toward eternity. You do remember that, don't you?
He spoke with the mild urging of a schoolmaster toward a somewhat backward student, yet Harlan thought he could detect a kind of hard glitter in his eye.
Harlan said, Of course.
You remember, too, that I told you that the All-When Council was reluctant to accept my analysis of the situation without specific confirming observations. Doesn't that imply to you that I had already computed the necessary reality change?
But my own observations represent the confirmation, don't they?
They do.
And it would take time to analyze them properly.
Nonsense. Your report means nothing. The confirmation lay in what you told me orally moments ago.
I don't understand you.
Look, Harlan, let me tell you what is wrong with the 482nd. Among the upper classes of this century, particularly among the women, there has grown up the notion that eternals are really eternal, literally so, that they live forever. Great time, man. Noyes Lambent told you as much. You repeated her statements to me not 20 minutes ago.
Harlan stared blankly at Finch. He was remembering Noyes's soft, caressing voice as she leaned toward him and caught at his eyes with her own lovely dark glance.
You live forever. You're an eternal.
Finch went on.
Now, a belief like that is bad, but in itself not too bad. It can lead to inconveniences, increased difficulties for the section, but computation would show that only in a minority of cases would change be necessary. Still, if a change is desirable, isn't it obvious to you that the inhabitants of the century who must, above all, change maximally with the change, be those who are subject to the superstition? In other words, the female aristocracy. Noyes.
It may be, but I'll take my chance, said Harlan.
You have no chance at all. Do you think your fascinations and charm persuaded the soft aristocrat to fall into the arms of an unimportant technician? Come, Harlan, be realistic about this.
Harlan's lips grew stubborn. He said nothing.
Finch said, Can't you guess the additional superstition which these people have added to their belief in the actual eternal life of the Eternals? Great time, Harlan.
Most of the women believe that intimacy with an Eternal will enable a mortal woman, as they think of themselves, to live forever.
Harlan swayed. He could hear Noyes's voice again so clearly. If I were made an Eternal. And then her kisses.
Finge went on.
The existence of such a superstition was hard to believe, Harlan. It was unprecedented. It lay within the region of random error so that a search through the computations for the previous change yielded no information respecting it one way or the other. The Orwen Council wanted firm evidence, direct substantiation. I chose Miss Lambent as a good example of her class. I chose you as the other subject.
Harlan struggled to his feet. You chose me as a subject?
I'm sorry, said Finge stiffly, but it was necessary. You made a very good subject.
Harlan stared at him.
Finge had the grace to squirm a bit under that wordless stare. He said, Don't you see? No, you still don't. Look, Harlan, you're a cold fish product of eternity. You won't look at a woman. You consider women and all that concerns them unethical. No, there's a better word. You consider them sinful. That attitude shows all over you, and to any woman you'd have all the sex appeal of a month-dead mackerel. Yet here we have a woman, the beautiful, pampered product of a hedonistic culture, who ardently seduces you on your first evening together, virtually begging for your embrace. Don't you understand that that is ridiculous? Impossible, unless, well, unless it is the confirmation we were looking for.
Harlan struggled for words. You say she sold herself.
Why that expression? There is no shame attached to sex in this century. The only strange thing is that she chose you as partner, and that she did for the sake of eternal life. It's plain.
And Harlan, arms raised, hands claw bent, with no rational thought in his mind or any irrational one other than to choke and throttle Finge, sprang forward. Finge stepped back hastily. He brought out a blaster with a quick, trembling gesture.
Don't touch me! Back!
Harlan had just enough sanity to halt his rush. His hair was matted. His shirt was stained with perspiration. His breath whistled through pinched white nostrils.
Finge said shakily, I know you very well, you see, and I thought your reaction might be violent. Now, I'll shoot if I have to.
Harlan said, Get out.
I will, but first you'll listen. For attacking a computer, you can be declassified, but we'll let that go.
You will understand, however, that I did not lie. The Noyes Lambent of the new reality, whatever else may be or not be, will lack this superstition.
The whole purpose of the change will be to wipe out the superstition, and without it, Harlan. His voice was almost a snarl. How could a woman like Noyes want a man like you?
The pudgy computer backed toward the door of Harlan's personal quarters, blaster still leveled. He paused to say with a sort of grim gaiety,
Of course, if you had her now, Harlan, if you had her now, you could enjoy her. You could keep your liaison and make it formal. That is, if you had her now. But the change will come soon, Harlan, and after that you will not have her. What a pity. The now does not last, even in eternity, eh, Harlan?
Harlan no longer looked at him. Finge had won after all and was leaving in clear and leering possession of the field. Harlan stared unseeingly at his own toes, and when he looked up, Finge was gone. Whether 5 seconds earlier or 15 minutes, Harlan could not have said. Hours had passed, nightmarishly, and Harlan felt trapped in the prison of his mind. All that Finge had said was so true, so transparently true. Harlan's observer mind could look back upon the relationship of himself and Noyes. That short, unusual relationship, and it took on a different texture. It wasn't a case of instant infatuation. How could he have believed it was?
infatuation for a man like himself? Of course not. Tears stung his eyes, and he felt ashamed. How obvious it was that the affair was a case of cool calculation. The girl had certain undeniable physical assets and no ethical principles to keep her from using them. So she used them, and that had nothing to do with Andrew Harlan as a person. He simply represented her distorted view of eternity and what it meant. Automatically, Harlan's long fingers caressed the volumes in his small bookshelf. He took one out and, unseeingly, opened it. The print blurred. The faded colors of the illustrations were ugly, meaningless blotches. Why had Finge troubled to tell him all this? In the strictest sense, he ought not to have. An observer, or anyone acting as observer, ought never to know the ends attained by his observation. It removed him by so much from the ideal position of the objective, non-human tool. It was to crush him, of course, to take a mean and jealous revenge. Harlan fingered the open page of the magazine. He found himself staring at a duplication, in startling red, of a ground vehicle similar to vehicles characteristic of the 45th, 182nd, 590th, and 984th centuries, as well as of late primitive times. It was a very common sort of affair with an internal combustion motor. In the primitive era, natural petroleum fractions were the source of power, and natural rubber cushioned the wheels. That was true of none of the later centuries, of course. Harlan had pointed that out to Cooper. He had made quite a point of it, and now his mind, as though longing to turn away from the unhappy present, drifted back to that moment. Sharp, irrelevant images filled the ache within Harlan. "These advertisements," he had said, "tell us more of primitive times than the so-called news articles in the same magazine. The news articles assume a basic knowledge of the world it deals with. It uses terms it feels no necessity of explaining. What is a golf ball, for instance?" Cooper had professed his ignorance readily. Harlan went on in the didactic tone he could scarcely avoid on occasions such as this. "We could deduce that it was a small pellet of some sort from the nature of the casual mentions it receives. We know that it is used in a game, if only because it is mentioned in an item under the heading Sport. We can even make further deductions that it is hit by a long rod of some sort, and the object of the game is to drive the ball into a hole in the ground. But why bother with deduction and reasoning? Observe this advertisement. The object of it is only to induce readers to buy the ball. But in so doing, we are presented with an excellent close-range portrait of one, with a section cut into it to show its construction." Cooper, coming from an era in which advertisement was not as wildly proliferative as it was in the later centuries of primitive times, found all this difficult to appreciate. He said, "Isn't it rather disgusting the way these people blow their own horn? Who would be fool enough to believe a person's boastings about his own products? Would he admit defects? Is he likely to stop at any exaggeration?" Harlan, whose home when was middling fruitful in advertisement, raised tolerant eyebrows and merely said, "You'll have to accept that. It's their way, and we never quarrel with the ways of any culture as long as it does not seriously harm mankind as a whole." But now, Harlan's mind snapped back to his present situation, and he was back in the present, staring at the loud-mouthed, brassy advertisements in the news magazine. He asked himself in sudden excitement, were the thoughts he had just experienced really irrelevant, or was he torturously finding a way out of the blackness and back to Noyes? Advertisement. A device for forcing the unwilling into line. Did it matter to a ground vehicle manufacturer whether a given individual felt an original or spontaneous desire for his product? If the prospect, that was the word, could be artificially persuaded or cajoled into feeling that desire and acting upon it, would that not be just as well?
Then what did it matter if Noyes loved him out of passion or out of calculation? Let them but be together long enough and she would grow to love him. He would make her love him, and in the end, love, and not its motivation, was what counted. He wished now he had read some of the novels out of time that Finch had mentioned scornfully. Harlan's fists clenched at a sudden thought. If Noyes had come to him, to Harlan, for immortality, it could only mean that she had not yet fulfilled the requirement for that gift. She could have made love to no eternal previously. That meant that her relationship to Finch had been nothing more than that of secretary and employer. Otherwise, what need would she have had for Harlan? Yet Finch surely must have tried, must have attempted. Harlan could not complete the thought even in the secrecy of his own mind. Finch could have proved the superstition's existence on his own person. Surely he could not have missed the thought with Noyes and ever-present temptation. Then she must have refused him. He had had to use Harlan, and Harlan had succeeded. It was for that reason that Finch had been driven into the jealous revenge of torturing Harlan with the knowledge that Noyes's motivation had been a practical one, and that he could never have her. Yet Noyes had refused Finch even with eternal life at stake, and had accepted Harlan. She had that much of a choice, and she had made it in Harlan's favor. So it wasn't calculation entirely. Emotion played a part. Harlan's thoughts were wild and jumbled and grew more heated with every moment. He must have her, and now, before any reality change. What was it Finch had said to him, jeering? "The now does not last, even in eternity." Doesn't it, though? Doesn't it? Harlan had known exactly what he must do. Finch's angry taunting had goaded him into a frame of mind where he was ready for crime, and Finch's final sneer had, at least, inspired him with the nature of the deed he must commit. He had not wasted a moment after that. It was with excitement and even joy that he left his quarters, at all but a run, to commit a major crime against eternity. Chapter 8. Crime. No one had questioned him. No one had stopped him. There was that advantage, anyway, in the social isolation of a technician. He went via the kettle channels to a door to time and set its controls. There was the chance, of course, that someone would happen along on a legitimate errand and wonder why the door was in use. He hesitated, and then decided to stamp his seal on the marker. A sealed door would draw little attention. An unsealed door in active use would be a 9-day wonder. Of course, it might be Finch who stumbled upon the door. He would have to chance that. Noyes was still standing as he had left her. Wretched hours, physio hours, had passed since Harlan had left the 482nd for a lonely eternity, but he returned now to the same time, within a matter of seconds, that he had left. Not a hair on Noyes's head had stirred. She looked startled. "Did you forget something, Andrew?" Harlan stared at her, hungrily, but made no move to touch her. He remembered Finch's words, and he dared not risk a repulse. He said stiffly, "You've got to do as I say." She said, "But is something wrong then? You just left. You just this minute left." "Don't worry," said Harlan. It was all he could do to keep from taking her hand, from trying to soothe her. Instead, he spoke harshly. It was as though some demon were forcing him to do all the wrong things. Why had he come back at the first available moment? He was only disturbing her by his almost instantaneous return after leaving. He knew the answer to that, really. He had a 2-day margin of grace allowed by the spatio-temporal chart. The earlier portions of that period of grace were safer and yielded least chance of discovery. It was a natural tendency to crowd it as far down when as he could. A foolish risk, too, though. He might easily have miscalculated and entered time before he had left it physio hours earlier. What then? It was one of the first rules he had learned as an observer. One person occupying two points in the same time of the same reality runs a risk of meeting himself. Somehow that was something to be avoided. Why? Harlan knew he didn't want to meet himself. He didn't want to be staring into the eyes of another and earlier or later Harlan. Beyond that, it would be a paradox. And what was it Twissell was fond of saying?
There are no paradoxes in time, but only because time deliberately avoids paradoxes.
All the time Harlan thought dizzily of all this, Noyes stared at him with large, luminous eyes. Then she came to him and put cool hands on either burning cheek and said softly, "You're in trouble." To Harlan her glance seemed kindly, loving. Yet how could that be? She had what she wanted. What else was there? He seized her wrists and said huskily, "Will you come with me, now? Without asking any questions, doing exactly as I say?"
"Must I?"
she asked.
"You must, Noyes. It's very important."
"Then I'll come." She said it matter-of-factly, as though such a request came to her each day and was always accepted. At the lip of the kettle, Noyes hesitated a moment, then stepped in. Harlan said, "We're going up when, Noyes?"
"That means the future, doesn't it?"
The kettle was already faintly humming as she entered it, and she was scarcely seated when Harlan unobtrusively moved the contact at his elbow. She showed no signs of nausea at the beginnings of that indescribable sensation of motion through time. He was afraid she might. She sat there quietly, so beautiful and so at ease that he ached, looking at her, and gave not the particle of a damn that, by bringing a timer unauthorized into eternity, he had committed a felony. She said,
"Does that dial show the numbers of the years, Andrew?"
"The centuries."
"You mean we're 1,000 years in the future already?"
"That's right."
"It doesn't feel like it."
"I know." She looked about.
"But how are we moving?"
"I don't know, Noyes."
"You don't?"
"There are many things about eternity that are hard to understand." The numbers on the temperometer marched. Faster and faster they moved till they were a blur. With his elbow, Harlan had nudged the speed stick to high. The power drain might cause some surprise in the power plants, but he doubted it. No one had been waiting for him in eternity when he returned with Noyes, and that was 9/10 the battle. Now it was only necessary to get her to a safe place. Again, Harlan looked at her. "Eternals don't know everything."
"And I'm not an eternal," she murmured. "I know so little."
Harlan's pulse quickened.
"Still not an eternal?" "But Finch said—"
"Leave it at that," he pleaded with himself. "Leave it at that. She's coming with you. She smiles at you. What more do you want?" But he spoke anyway. He said, "You think an eternal lives forever, don't you?"
"Well, they call them eternals, you know, and everyone says they do." She smiled at him brightly. "But they don't, do they?"
"You don't think so, then?"
"After I was in eternity for a while, I didn't. People didn't talk as though they lived forever and there were old men there.
Yet you told me I lived forever, that night." She moved closer to him, along the seat, still smiling.
"I thought, who knows?"
He said, without being quite able to keep the strain out of his voice, "How does a timer go about becoming an eternal?" Her smile vanished, and was it his imagination or was there a trace of heightened color in her cheek?
She said, "Why do you ask that?"
"To find out."
"It's silly,"
she said.
"I'd rather not talk about it."
She stared down at her graceful fingers, edged with nails that glittered colorlessly in the muted light of the kettle shaft. Harlan thought abstractedly and quite apropos of nothing that at an evening gathering with a touch of mild ultraviolet in the wall illumination, Those nails would glow a soft apple green or a brooding crimson, depending on the angle she held her hands. A clever girl, one like Noyes, could produce half a dozen shades out of them and make it seem as though the colors were reflecting her moods. Blue for innocence, bright yellow for laughter, violet for sorrow, and scarlet for passion. He said, "Why did you make love to me?" She shook her hair back and looked at him out of a pale, grave face. She said, "If you must know, part of the reason was the theory that a girl can become an eternal that way. I wouldn't mind living forever."
"I thought you said you didn't believe that."
"I didn't, but it couldn't hurt a girl to take the chance, especially—" He was staring at her sternly, finding refuge from hurt and disappointment in a frozen look of disapproval from the heights of the morality of his home when.
"Well?"
"Especially since I wanted to anyway."
"Wanted to make love to me?"
"Yes."
"Why me?"
"Because I liked you. Because I thought you were funny."
"Funny?"
"Well, odd, if you like that better. You always worked so hard not to look at me, but you always looked at me anyway. You tried to hate me, and I could see you wanted me. I was sorry for you a little, I think."
"What were you sorry about?"
He felt his cheeks burning. "That you should have such trouble about wanting me is such a simple thing. You just ask a girl. It's so easy to be friendly, why suffer?"
Harlan nodded. The morality of the 482nd. "Just ask a girl," he muttered.
"So simple. Nothing more necessary. The girl has to be willing, of course. Mostly she is if she's not otherwise engaged. Why not? It's simple enough."
It was Harlan's turn to drop his eyes. Of course it was simple enough. And nothing wrong with it either. Not in the 482nd. Who in eternity should know this better? He would be a fool, an utter and unspeakable fool, to ask her now about earlier affairs. He might as well ask a girl of his own home when, if she had ever eaten in the presence of a man, and how dared she? Instead, he said humbly,
"And what do you think of me now?" "That you are very nice," she said softly, "and that if you ever relaxed, won't you smile?"
"There's nothing to smile about, Noyes."
"Please, I want to see if your cheeks can crease right. Let's see."
She put her fingers to the corners of his mouth and pressed them backward. He jerked his head back in surprise and couldn't avoid smiling.
"See? Your cheeks didn't even crack. You're almost handsome. With enough practice, standing in front of a mirror and smiling and getting a twinkle in your eye, I'll bet you could be really handsome." But the smile, fragile enough to begin with, vanished. Noyes said, "We are in trouble, aren't we?"
"Yes, we are, Noyes. Great trouble."
"Because of what we did, you and I, that evening?"
"Not really."
"That was my fault, you know. I'll tell them so if you wish."
"Never," said Harlan with energy. "Don't take on any fault in this. You've done nothing, nothing to be guilty for. It's something else."
Noyes looked uneasily at the temperometer. "Where are we? I can't even see the numbers."
"When are we?" Harlan corrected her automatically. He slowed the velocity and the centuries came into view. Her beautiful eyes widened and the lashes stood out against the whiteness of her skin.
"Is that right?"
Harlan looked at the indicator casually. "It was in the 72,000s. "I'm sure it is."
"But where are we going?"
"To when are we going?" "To the far up when," he said grimly. "Good and far, where they won't find you." And in silence, they watched the numbers mount. In silence, Harlan told himself over and over that the girl was innocent of Finch's charge. She had owned up frankly to its partial truth, and she had admitted, just as frankly, the presence of a more personal attraction. He looked up then, as Noyes shifted position. She had moved to his side of the kettle, and with a resolute gesture, brought the kettle to a halt at a most uncomfortable temporal deceleration. Harlan gulped and closed his eyes to let the nausea pass.
He said,
"What's the matter?"
She looked ashen, and for a moment made no reply. Then she said,
"I don't want to go any further, the numbers are so high."
The temperometer read 111,394. He said,
"Far enough."
Then he held out his hand gravely.
"Come, Noyes, this will be your home for a while."
They wandered through the corridors like children, hand in hand. The lights along the main ways were on, and the darkened rooms blazed at the touch of a contact. The air was fresh, and had a liveliness about it which, without sensible draft, yet indicated the presence of ventilation.
Noyes whispered, "Is there no one here?"
"No one," said Harlan.
He tried to say it firmly and loudly. He wanted to break the spell of being in a hidden century, but he said it in only a whisper after all. He did not even know how to refer to anything so far up when. To call it the 111,394th was ridiculous. One would have to say simply and indefinitely the hundred thousands. It was a foolish problem to be concerned with, but now that the exaltation of actual flight was done with, he found himself alone in a region of eternity where no human footsteps had wandered, and he did not like it. He was ashamed, doubly ashamed since Noyes was witness, at the fact that the faint chill within him was the faint chill of a faint fear.
Noyes said, "It's so clean. There's no dust."
"Self-cleaning," said Harlan.
With an effort that seemed to tear at his vocal cords, he raised his voice to near normal level.
"But no one's here, up when or down when, for thousands and thousands of centuries."
Noyes seemed to accept that.
"And everything is fixed up so? We passed food stores and a viewing film library, did you see that?"
"I saw that. Oh, it's fully equipped. They're all fully equipped, every section."
"But why, if no one ever comes here?"
"It's logical," said Harlan.
Talking about it took away some of the eeriness. Saying out loud what he already knew in the abstract would pinpoint the matter, bring it down to the level of the prosaic. He said, "Early in the history of eternity, one of the centuries in the 300s came up with a mass duplicator. Do you know what I mean? By setting up a resonating field, energy could be converted to matter with subatomic particles taking up precisely the same pattern of positions within the uncertainty requirements as those in the model being used. The result is an exact copy. We, in eternity, commandeered the instrument for our own purposes. At that time, there were only about 600 or 700 sections built up. We had plans for expansion, of course. 10 new sections a physio year was one of the slogans of the time. The mass duplicator made that all unnecessary. We built one new section complete with food, power supply, water supply, all the best automatic features, set up the machine and duplicated the section once each century, all along eternity. I don't know how long they kept it going, millions of centuries probably."
"All like this, Andrew?"
"All exactly like this. And as eternity expands, we just fill in, adapting the construction to whatever fashion turns out to be current in the century. The only troubles come when we hit an energy-centered century. We haven't reached this section yet." No use telling her that the Eternals couldn't penetrate into time here, in the hidden centuries. What difference did that make? He glanced at her, and she seemed troubled. He said hastily, "There's no waste involved in building the sections. It took energy, nothing more. And with the Nova to draw on..."
She interrupted, "No, I just don't remember."
"Remember what?"
"You said the duplicator was invented in the 300s. We don't have it in the 482nd. I don't remember viewing anything about it in history."
Harlan grew thoughtful.
Although she was within 2 inches of being as tall as himself, he suddenly felt giant size by comparison. She was a child, an infant, and he was a demigod of eternity who must teach her and lead her carefully to the truth.
He said, "Noyes, dear, let's find a place to sit down and I'll have to explain something."
The concept of a variable reality,
A reality that was not fixed and eternal and immutable was not one that could be faced casually by anyone. In the dead of the sleep period, sometimes, Harlan would remember the early days of his cubhood and recall the wrenching attempts to divorce himself from his century and from time. It took 6 months for the average cub to learn all the truth, to discover that he could never go home again in a very literal way. It wasn't eternity's law alone that stopped him, but the frigid fact that home, as he knew it, might very well no longer exist, might, in a sense, never have existed. It affected cubs differently. Harlan remembered Bonky La Tourette's face turning white and gaunt the day Instructor Yarrow had finally made it unmistakably clear about reality. None of the cubs ate that night. They huddled together in search of a kind of psychic warmth, all except La Tourette, who had disappeared. There was a lot of false laughter and miserably poor joking. Someone said with a voice that was tremulous and uncertain, "I suppose I never had a mother. If I go back into the 95th, they'd say, 'Who are you? We don't know you. We don't have any records of you. You don't exist.'" They smiled weakly and nodded their heads, lonely boys with nothing left but eternity. They found La Tourette at bedtime, sleeping deeply and breathing shallowly. There was the slight reddening of a spray injection in the hollow of his left elbow, and fortunately, that was noted too. Yarrow was called, and for a while it looked as though one cub would be out of the course, but he was brought around eventually. A week later, he was back in his seat, yet the mark of that evil night was on his personality for as long as Harlan knew him thereafter. And now, Harlan had to explain reality to Noyes Lambent, a girl not much older than those cubs, and explain it at once and in full. He had to. There was no choice about that. She must learn exactly what faced them and exactly what she would have to do. He told her. They ate canned meats, chilled fruits, and milk at a long conference table designed to hold 12, and there he told her. He did it as gently as possible, but he scarcely found need for gentleness. She snapped quickly at every concept, and before he was half through it, was borne in upon him, to his great amazement, that she wasn't reacting badly. She wasn't afraid. She showed no sense of loss. She only seemed angry. The anger reached her face and turned it a glowing pink, while her dark eyes seemed somehow the darker for it. "But that's criminal," she said. "Who are the Eternals to do this?" "It's done for humanity's good," said Harlan. Of course, she couldn't really understand that. He felt sorry for the time-bound thinking of a timer. "Is it? I suppose that's how the mass duplicator was wiped out." "We have copies still. Don't worry about that. We've preserved it." "You've preserved it. But what about us? We of the 482nd might have had it." She gestured with little movements of two clenched fists. "It wouldn't have done you good. Look, don't get excited, dear, and listen." With an almost convulsive gesture, he would have to learn how to touch her naturally, without making the movement seem a sheepish invitation to a repulse. He took her hands in his and held them tightly.